Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Dominic Fifield of The Athletic. It's FA Cup semi-final weekend, one of the signposts of the season. It kicks off with a potential preview of the Champions League final between Chelsea and Manchester City. Then, on Sunday, Leicester meet Southampton, with 4,000 fans allowed inside the modern mausoleum that is Wembley. The Saints have had a season of emotional contrasts and the occasional beating. Leicester will be favourites to reach the final. Dom, can they overcome this ominous wobble they've had in the Premier League lately?
They can, and they've got players who owe the manager a performance now following their COVID breaches last weekend. The quality is there in that Leicester team, certainly to overcome the wobble. I mean, we're talking, you know, a defeat to Manchester City and a loss at a resurgent West Ham United. So it's hardly disaster time in terms of the results that have slipped. And I think Leicester would look at their next four league fixtures, West Brom, Palace, Southampton and Newcastle, as a very good opportunity for them to regain momentum in their league pursuit of the top four finish. But moreover, this is their first FA Cup semi-final, I think, since 1982. I think they've got their motivation is to progress in this competition and to claim silverware again, and that will be motivation enough. I mean, that really should get the juices flowing of this hugely talented, young, vibrant team who have had another excellent season. I mean, it's like last season. I know they tailed off towards the end of last season in that surreal post-lockdown period, but the bottom line is they've done really, really well and they've been consistently excellent throughout. So, yes, they can recover, absolutely. And they will see this game against Southampton on Sunday as an opportunity to showcase their abilities.
Mm. Yeah, as Dom mentioned there, Miguel, Brendan Rodgers, were you impressed by his strength of management in dropping those players for defying the COVID restrictions? And it did have a bit of the air of the Fergie about it, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when I heard it, I mean, my first thought was the famous story of Sharp and Giggs, or I think as Fergie called them, 5 and 11 by their squad numbers, hadn't their names. I don't know if Rodgers did that. But yeah, I mean, it was particularly strong given the stage of the season, given the wider context about Leicester's slide. And as Dom says now, those players really owe a performance. And that's where we could see the wider effect of Rodgers' management. But I mean, obviously there's been a lot of parallels with last season, a lot of people thinking that Leicester will drop off in the same way. There are probably differences. And one of them I do think, actually, is that Leicester have actually had more injuries throughout this season. So have a lot of players to come back fresh for this final stretch. So that's why, as Dom said, they weren't, the performance against West Ham, I say, was more worrying than the City performance. But it wasn't a total collapse either way. They came close to coming back. And I do think they have a bit more in the tank. And this semi-final could be what sparks them again.
With Rodgers and his background, he basically comes from that development coaching background, doesn't he, Dom? Reading, Chelsea. Do you think that firmness of purpose that he showed in acting as a disciplinarian was actually a product of his previous career in terms of that's what you need to do when you're dealing with younger players?
Yeah, it must have come into it. I mean, he could easily have just fined the players, given them a slap on the wrist, and allowed them to play. But by sort of cutting off his nose despite his face, he's made a bigger statement. And I think it reflects the philosophy that he has, he's implemented at that club. And that is, that is something that's steeped in his, you know, the work he's done in youth systems and in academies, I think, over the years. He's asking for responsibility. He's asking for his players to take responsibility for their actions, really. And, you know, if they do cross the line, then they will be punished. And even if that is to the detriment of the team. And I guess the idea is to try and get them to have a bit of pride in how they conduct themselves and you know, thinking about the bigger picture all the time. And you know what? Of all those the players that were involved in that COVID breach, I suspect that the one he's most upset with and disappointed in is actually the most experienced member of the team, Wes Morgan, who was also there apparently. And I mean, his presence, the club captain's presence. I mean, he's not a mainstay of the team anymore by any stretch of the imagination. He's a bit part player these days, but it probably offered, I don't know, it probably validated almost to the younger players who were attending that party that they could be there. But the fact that they had a player in his mid-30s with all that weight of experience on his shoulders, and he was there as well. So it probably set the wrong tone that the others followed. And that will have disappointed Rodgers most of all because they did all let him down. They let the club down, but they let Rodgers down. And I think it's a brilliant stance. I mean, look, it's damaged Leicester. I mean, would they have lost at West Ham had those guys been fit? I mean, Maddison in particular is a massive loss to Leicester City. And then Perez would arguably be playing some of the better football of his Leicester City career when he's absent now. So it has hurt them. But I think the wider message that he's put out there is very much more beneficial to the club and the development of those players.
Yeah, well, it's all about taking responsibility for your actions. And you know, you mentioned James Maddison. Miggs, with Gareth Southgate warning about distraction, he's blown his chance of making the Euros, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, it feels like that completely. I mean, we had a dailies with Southgate on Tuesday. Jacob Steinberg of The Guardian made a point of asking him about this. And, you know, Southgate gave his usual spiel about discipline, but also stress. He really made a point of saying how at the end of the autumn fixtures, he sat the players down for a chat about this because there'd been so many distractions through breaches, how the March fixtures were so much more, you know, easy to prepare for without him. And I mean, there was already uncertainty about Maddison. I remember someone in football put it to me at the time that one of the reasons Maddison was doing more interviews was almost if they felt because to make himself more visible, because there was a danger just completely dropping off the picture. And now, given that, and given that the emphasis that Southgate has put on team discipline and what's happened over the last year, it feels like now his chances are absolutely zero, unless he does something incredible in the final few games of the campaign. But even then, given the competition for places, it's really hard to see.
He's only got one cap, hasn't he? And this was a player that Southgate was actually in person at the London Stadium to watch. He was there, and his absence would have been keenly felt on that respect. I completely agree with Miggs. I just can't see how he makes a late run into that England setup, given the other options that Southgate has, and if indeed how some of those players, who I'm sure we'll discuss later on, are excelling at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. When you think about it, impressions of unreliability do linger in football, don't they? Because it is such a global village. In playing terms, Miggs, Kelechi Iheanacho, 7 in 5, can he keep masking the poor form of Vardy?
It's interesting because, I mean, Dom mentioned there about other players coming ahead of Madison that we're going to mention. one of them is Lingard. And without getting into his form, though, his current streak, good as he is, feels like the definition of a hot streak in football. Except Iheanacho is probably almost on the same sort of run. No, it doesn't feel like it can rely upon just by virtue of the fact that going by Iheanacho's previous career, going by how these things go, it will run out at some point, possibly some point when it's most inconvenient. And I think Leicester have to get back to what they have maybe made more of a virtue of this season, which is having more goals from around the team, or rather more threat from around the team, which meant Vardy was kind of, rather than everything going through him, meant he was just topping that off. And I suppose it's another one of these little issues that has just allowed Leicester to kind of to just about hang on to their to where they are when there is a threat of things kind of dissipating a little bit. But yeah, it is something Rodgers has to work on.
Yeah, with the threat posed by Southampton, Dom, I suppose in many ways it's almost a free hit for Southampton. This is their season condensed into 90 or maybe 120 minutes. What threat will they pose, perhaps just beyond James Ward-Prowse and Danny Ings? Is that the problem, that they're a little bit one-dimensional?
Well, they've got the ammunition there. They've got a lot of pace in that team. Armstrong's excellent as well. I mean, they have got ability. It's been, their downturn has been surprising. I mean, bear in mind, this was a team that topped the division, topped the Premier League at one point in the autumn. They seem to be, all that good form. They always have one amazing run of form in a season. They had it early this year. They usually have it at the end of a season, and that their tail off has been dramatic. I don't think it is a free hit. I don't think you can. I think when you're in that run of form, and when you've been humiliated at West Bromwich Albion only last week, and just how badly things have gone in the Premier League, they clearly have put all their eggs in one basket, which means that this is not a free hit. This is, as you say, this is their season, and that puts more pressure on them to deliver. But they're going to need, they're going to need Ward-Prowse to pull the strings, and they're going to need Ings to be razor sharp, but they're also going to need, the pace of Redmond. They're going to need the influence of Armstrong. They're going to need that defence rekindling some of the form from earlier in the season, and they haven't shown that very often of late. I know they've had injuries and disruption as well, as like every club have in the division, but there are a lot of players there that have to step up now and seize this as an opportunity as well, because let's be honest, as good as Leicester have been this season, Southampton would have preferred to face them than the other two teams in the semi-final. So this is an opportunity for them to get to the final of the competition and remind themselves of how good they should be.
Having said all that, Miggs, can you see that Leicester taking advantage of a defence which certainly in recent evidence looks pretty fundamentally flawed?
You would think that should be the case, but I was doing I'm doing a piece in this for the weekend. I was doing a bit of research and kind of, form going into semi-finals and, how much I can firm. And it is very, very 50. It's a fixture. And I suppose maybe this is because the nature of the World Cup, the nature of the FA Cup these days, that can actually throw up a few wildcard results. And Southampton, should they get to the final, they would be the team on the worst form to do so since. Any ideas?
Blimey.
It is Palace 2016.
In 2016? Yeah, that would be about right. We were dreadful that second half of the season.
but I mean, to be fair to that Palace, this Southampton form goes back way, it goes back longer. And I this is why it isn't, whatever about a free hit for the club, it's certainly not a free hit for Hasenhüttl. Because as Dom says, it does feel like he has put all his eggs into this tournament, that it's almost like they've set aside league form for this. And I think that comes across because suddenly there are, especially among the fan base, a few concerns about the drop-off. And even from little bits you hear now around the squad, well, obviously so much has been made of how Hasenhüttl coaches, and he is usually admired for that. But and he has been talked about as another Klopp for many obvious reasons. But, the comparisons only go so far because there are a few little murmurs that he maybe isn't as warm as Klopp, and some of the players have found, found he can be difficult. Now, of course, these are the sort of stories that always come out more in spells of bad form, like when they got beaten 9-0 the first time, which is an amazing sentence in itself. But the club persevered. And then, you know, once the coaching takes effect, then, you know, previous quibbles are forgotten. But there is a little something there. And I think it's why there is a pressure. If this season peters out now with this defeat and they kind of end up finishing 15th or 16th, Hasenhüttl, for all he was praised, and it's not too long ago, Tottenham would have seen him as a potential replacement for Jose Mourinho if and when they do make that change. You know, his job could be in danger.
Yeah, and I suppose everyone would be looking at the other semi-final as to try and find the identity of the winners of the whole competition. Dom, Chelsea's prospects against City in, you know, as we said earlier, what could be a preview of the Champions League final, they've had an extra 24 hours rest. Is that a factor, do you think, in what's really been a relentless season?
I think it probably will play a little part. I suspect the sports scientists at City know how to maximise the use of the time that they've got and between their Dortmund tie and the semi-final. But yeah, I mean, Chelsea were in Spain. They would have got back in the small hours of Wednesday morning. They would have rested up, I would have thought, throughout Wednesday. So yeah, they should be slightly more refreshed. I don't think that extra 24 hours is going to be beneficial in terms of getting back injured players. I mean, Mateo Kovacic, I don't think, will feature at the weekend, and that is a major blow for Chelsea because he has been excellent of late, and he's one of their players that breaks a press. I don't feel very comfortable using all these modern young terms, I have to say, but apparently that's what happens. His absence will be keenly felt. So there'll be an even more of a reliance upon N'Golo Conte, who isn't fully fit himself. They need the likes of Jorginho to step up. And as excellent as Jorginho was against an anemic Crystal Palace on Saturday and a strangely subdued Porto through large periods on Tuesday night. He tends to get overwhelmed in games against the elite teams, particularly in the Premier League. So that's another test of his caliber, you know, at Wembley this weekend. And it's a test of Tuchel as well, because I think this is, you know, this will tell us a lot more about how good Chelsea are under his coaching and his setup and the confidence that they'll have gained from, you know, I know it's two defeats now in 17, isn't it? But Tuesday didn't really feel like a defeat, really. So it's an intriguing tie from Chelsea's perspective. I think it'll be a really difficult one for them, but they will have a chance. And I do wonder whether coming up again, if Pep decides to pick his Aguero Jesus team as opposed to the team full of fluent attacking midfielders, weirdly, I think that might actually benefit Chelsea slightly to be able to have two distinct forwards that they can mark with their three at the back. That might make life slightly easier for them, but only slightly.
Mm. How important do you think N'Golo Kante will be? He seems to be the hub of a team that Tuchel's trying to depict as relatively inexperienced.
Yeah, I mean, and you only have to look at the wealth of trophies, even the way he takes responsibility in so many different senses. And I suppose it's particularly key in a game like this. One of the things that struck me, I know we'll get onto the Champions League in a bit, but what struck about the City's win over Dortmund, which you maybe would expect this game to go in the same way. I mean, right, Tuchel has been more possession-based, but this is going to be a game where they'll probably seed it. And once City got ahead against Dortmund, and kind of it's almost like those nerves had calmed from what was another pretty fraught situation in Europe for them, but one that could now be another key point in the season in what it does with them psychologically. But you'd expect City to try play through Chelsea in a similar way. And it's in situations like that, Kante is never more important just because he has that energy and leads the way in terms of breaking things up. He could be the most influential player on the pitch on Saturday.
It's interesting to see how the bigger picture is beginning to form around Tuchel, or what we now, I suppose, have to call Tuchel's Chelsea. Thiago Silva talking glowingly about his new coach, looking maybe to get a new contract. He's talking about the 2022 World Cup. The team development, if they are short, Dom, in what areas are they short?
Well, they lack a number nine. They lack a natural number nine. If they went out and bought a Haaland-type figure, then they would be a considerable threat to in the Premier League title race, I'd argue. I think they actually, for all that Thiago Silva has done well and has obviously been influential, they also probably lack a centre-back of his, a younger centre-back who they can build on for the future. But I think Tuchel's done brilliantly with the players at his disposal, like most new Chelsea managers tend to do when they come in mid-season, it has to be said. There's only really been Gus Hiddink's second time round, who he struggled to a certain extent to raise a flagging team. And even he went on a 10-match unbeaten run initially, although most of those were draws. So we shouldn't get carried away with what Tuchel's done, but he has done well. But the summer will show, I think, a different Tuchel. I think we'll see a ruthless Thomas Tuchel in terms of the recruitment that Chelsea muster. I think the players that he allows to leave will also be quite interesting, and if there could be some noses put out of joint a bit, I don't think he'll be afraid of doing that, and he'll have the backing of the board, particularly if he continues along the path that his team is travelling at the moment. And let's be honest, they are challenging well on all the fronts that he was asked to do. And it's the Champions League semi-final for the first time since 2014. It's an excellent return. I think he's probably favourites to finish in the top four, the way things have gone in the league. Still got the FA Cup, obviously, this weekend. I think the board will back him, and there will be more investment in the summer, and it wouldn't surprise me if some of those additions are made are surprising in terms of who they dislodge.
Mm. Do you think they're capable of winning the Champions League, Migs?
Yeah, I've thought that for some time. And I think when I was thinking this back in February, March, it was more based on the fact that in a season like this, with a schedule as congested as this, all of their most high-profile and most important players have played fewer minutes than all of their rivals. I think at one stage it was something like, say, they had 1,000 minutes less than the equivalent players at Manchester United or Manchester City, which is what? That's 10, 11 games. That's huge. But, of course, even since then, they've grown as a team. And I think Dom is right as well, that this is about... there's a difference in situations like this between steadily building form when it matters, but you don't absolutely have to do it in any given game, and then a match like this where suddenly there's this concrete consequence, and especially against what might be the best team in Europe, certainly the best team in England, that this is more of a do or die test. And I think it's going to be interesting to see where they are and maybe tell a little bit for this Champions League. But I think they've got the quality, they've got the squad depth, they've got an exceptional manager who maybe is in terms of like you in the Champions League might be at a good point, because I suppose we already know, when he got the job, there's already previous talk about sometimes the friction that Tuchel can cause. Well, it already feels very premature for that. Obviously, things have been going quite well at Chelsea. So they might just be in a good place and things might fall for them well. And I imagine, say, if it's Tuchel against his old club in the final, I'd certainly fancy him against Real Madrid, I have to say. But I think they're in a good place going into the end of the season. And even allowing for City's amazing last few months, this is pretty much a 50-50 game, I think.
Yeah, well, Pep Guardiola's reached his 8th Champions League semi-final. It's not one for the romantics, is it? City and PSG, when we look at the broader ramifications of those two clubs. But Manchester City, as they stand at the moment, there were questions asked in Dortmund. Did they answer them effectively enough, Dom, for you to be convinced of their potential?
Yeah, I think so. That tie probably... The quality of Dortmund was maybe a bit underestimated from the outside. I mean, everybody sort of fixated on Haaland, but actually Dortmund are a really good team. And it's encouraging as an Englishman to see that Jude Bellingham making such progress there and looking the part. And you know, on the back of those two performances against City, and indeed his form in the Bundesliga this season, you just hope that he's involved in and heavily involved in Southgate's squad come the summer. But you know, City had to deal with a setback. They were trailing at half time. They were playing catch up in the tie at half time on Wednesday night, and they reacted. And there have been times in the Champions League quarterfinals where their sort of world has imploded under Pep in recent years. So in that respect, it's clear progress. A first semi-final for him at the club, a second in the club's history. And yeah, nothing from those two games particularly made me think City aren't going to be capable of reaching the final and winning it. It's encouraging that they're finding different ways of winning matches, and even in adversity, they're steeling themselves, and they can rely on such wonderful players as Phil Foden. I mean, what a talent he's becoming as well.
Mentioning Foden there, Migs, as his development methods, or certainly the methods employed on him, have they been fully justified? Because he hasn't been rushed in. You know, on this show, we were throwing up our arms, weren't we, saying, why doesn't he play more? Why isn't he a regular? Maybe he's been treated in the right way, delicately, and now he is going to flourish. Do you agree with that?
It feels like that's the case. And I have to say, I mean, I do think some of the initial concerns about Foden were fair. That shouldn't be underestimated knowledge, because you talk to anyone in that sphere of development, and the consensus is always that, I mean, in fact, I think UEFA have published figures in this. I don't know, it's also the foundation, say, of Leipzig's approach, that if you don't play a certain amount of, or it's something like, all of the players that play in the Champions League have played a certain amount of football between the ages of 17 and 20. And those are crucial ages to be getting first team experience. And it's a particular point when players basically need their talent honed by proper professional competitiveness. Now, I suppose, while that may be true for the general approach, the reality is also that every single player is different. So from that, and I mean, that, I suppose that is the context of why there was such concern for Foden initially, because he didn't seem to be getting the regular football that his talent warranted he should. And I think it's why there were fair calls to send him out on loan. But yeah, every player responds differently. And now, I suppose, from obviously the inside and very intimate information that City have and that Guardiola would have, it transpires they've taken what is exactly the right choice, or the right choices for Foden. And now, I mean, we're at a point now where it's not just obviously he's making good in his talent, but I think he's probably City's most important player after De Bruyne. I mean, certainly in terms of goal scoring effect, you got the two really crucial goals in this tie.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly that semi-final against PSG is you know, really worth looking forward to. What do you make of the development of PSG under Pochettino, Dom? Perhaps not so decorative or individualistic, maybe more of a collective ethos?
Possibly, and that would fit into what Pochettino would have his teams be, I guess. It still feels a bit early days. I mean, we shouldn't hide away from the fact that their form in Ligue 1 is not impressive, really. I mean, with that calibre of player to call upon, they shouldn't be ceding the league title potentially to Lille, a club in horrible financial difficulty, and you have to operate in a very different way to PSG. But in Europe, yes, they've impressed. I mean, they did get to the final of this competition last season, so they're actually maintaining standards more than setting new standards, although it was a statement for them to eliminate Bayern Munich. I mean, that's inescapable. Doesn't get any easier for them from now on in. Collective and individual, I don't know. I still look at that PSG team and think it's largely about what Mbappe and Neymar do, and they're both wonderful, wonderful players. And if you have those players in your team, then why wouldn't you set up with, you know, you nine guys do all the work and let these two inflict all the wounds? I mean, it's they're that good. But it's too early probably to judge on Pochettino in terms of the philosophy that he's trying to impose there. It's not an easy job, really, because given that he took over a Champions League finalist. So I mean, there's only one place he can go to improve upon that, really, isn't it? Let's be honest. And he's done everything he can to, having got them out of the group just about, and to achieve that. So let's see what progress it makes and how they cope with City in the semi.
The one thing I would say, John, just on that, sorry, is that I think there is a bit of a difference in that last season, on the run to the final, Paris Saint-Germain basically beat clubs that they should be beating and kind of a lesser status. And in some ways, I mean, this isn't trying to diminish what Tuchel did, but I suppose it's still a bit of reality. In some ways, it was still like previous season, and they ultimately got knocked out by, you know, the first super club or team of equivalent level they played, even though if this happened to be in the final this time. And I think this is where the teams they've eliminated this season have been significant, because, okay, it might be a diluted Barca, but it's still Barca. And you can't really make any of those criticisms of Bayern Munich, given they're the European champions, even without Lewandowski, because, you know, PSG had their own absence. I think Marquinhos was pretty key, given that attack. And I suppose what seemed a little bit different about this game, yes, obviously, of course, Neymar and Mbappe set everything. But for this tie, and especially in the second leg, it was that kind of defensive trident that were particularly valuable and ended up being really important, particularly Pereira, given he doesn't even like playing centre half. And I mean, yeah, you're right, it's early days, but it's difficult not to associate that with the kind of that kind of grit and resolve that Pochettino tries to make such a core of his teams.
There was a noticeable narrative after that Bayern win, Dom, that Neymar is underappreciated. I couldn't get my head around it personally. You know, he's someone who's scored, I think, 67 goals in as many Champions League games. What's your appreciation of Neymar in terms of where he stands, you know, in that great pantheon we always talk about?
Well, I guess the criticism of him is probably born of this being a player that walked away from Barcelona because he didn't want to live in what he perceived to be the shadows of other players in that front three. I guess it's also a legacy of maybe some of the play acting on the pitch. But in his defence on that, he is a player that's actually been kicked out of tournaments. I mean, kicked to pieces on the pitch over the years. So I don't have I have a bit of sympathy for him, you know, if he goes down having with some of the treatment that he's subjected to. I just think he's a wonderful, wonderful player, and he's a Brazilian footballer, you know, number 10. He scores wonderful goals. He's got quick feet. He's actually got everything you'd want. You know, if you're a young kid growing up and you wanted to be a footballer, he's probably what you'd want to be. He has the romance of it all and the brilliance and the effervescence. That is what Neymar is. And maybe people are belatedly realizing that now. Look, it doesn't help that he went off and sort of he went to Ligue 1 as well at a time when for an astronomical and fee of money that people found maybe a bit distasteful. And he just looked like a massive fish in a tiny, tiny pond for a while. But I think what he's doing in Europe sets him apart still. I think he is a wonderful player. I mean, that's inescapable. You can't deny that. He's brilliant at what he does.
When Neymar is on it, I think he's possibly maybe at least top three players to watch in the world. I think he's absolutely joyous to watch. But as you say, it's just, I think for a lot of people, it can be difficult to detach that from everything that goes on around him. And then there are questions about how often he turns it on, which I think is a bit unfair. Neymar shouldn't really be detached from the kind of situation he grew up and developed in. And it's probably a pressure, for all the people think of him as some sort of kind of, you know, feckless and dull star, it's really a pressure that more players than anyone have had to deal with. I mean, I was at that opening game in the 2014 World Cup, and like just the weight of expectation on him was something like I've never experienced. And he went and scored a crucial goal in that game. But let's not forget as well, this is a guy that essentially since he was a child, he was seen as Brazil's next saviour, openly talked about, especially because he also developed at what was something of a little bit of a more fallow period for Brazilian football. But he was willingly talked up as the next Pelé, having always to deal with that. Because of that as well, this, you might call it kind of this Neymar industrial complex group around him, where he has this ridiculous entourage of people. Obviously, there's been the influences of his father. And like, I've spoken to a few people that have worked with him and say, Neymar himself is actually just, if you get him on his own, and he's actually quite a nice, innocent kid, he'll do anything to help. But just there's this kind of whole business that has grown up around him. And I remember being told an extension of that. Now, again, I imagine there's a lot of influences here, but that have guided this. But I suppose this possibly points to kind of one of the bigger issues of him, that it was actually, I mean, there's always been this perception that he was forced to get to Paris Saint-Germain against his will, but I remember being told that he actually wanted to go there partly because he wanted to be his own man, which I think is something that says an awful lot, given certain perceptions of him and given how bizarrely constricted his life has been, despite the obvious freedom of so much money and so much fame.
Yeah, I always find it particularly instructive to look at clips from early on in a player's career. You know, I was watching an early Neymar performance against Ronaldinho in an amazing game, a 4-3 game. And, you know, you used the right adjective, Dom, joyous. The way he manipulated the ball, he wasn't just a dribbler. The dexterity that he had was amazing. And sometimes I suppose we lose that because we do talk about, you know, we're doing it with Haaland at the moment. We're talking about them as commodities rather than individuals and people, you know, cut them and they bleed and all that. I suppose football is a really harsh business. And well, you look at the fallout from the Champions League semi-finals. Looks likely now that Hansi Flick's going to leave Bayern, probably to join the national team. We're talking about Nagelsmann as another domino to fall, maybe going to Bayern. It's harsh, especially on coaches. Because Pochettino's stock is so high, Dom, is that very bad news for Jose Mourinho?
I don't think things are great for Jose Mourinho, regardless of how much Pochettino's been doing with PSG, to be perfectly honest. Really, really weird situation at Spurs. I mean, I've watched quite a few of their games of late, and I have no affiliation with Tottenham Hotspur. I have no feelings either way for them, but I've been left tearing my hair out at the amount of natural ability and talent in that squad, and how seldom it's demonstrated out on the pitch. And I'm talking attacking talent primarily. I mean, we all fixate on Kane, and there was a period this season where we lumped Son in there as well, but throughout that squad there's lavish ability and creativity and incision and brilliant players, and yet this is a team that can be so passive for so long in so many games. And unfortunately, as much as he would rail against it and he would insist that it's not down to him, that is the responsibility of a coach to stop that from happening. He has to get more out of those players. He has to coax more out of their players. He has to, if it's an issue with confidence, then he has to raise their spirits. A coach of his ability, of his standing, of his pedigree, and everything that he's achieved in the game should be able to raise that team. And as it is at the moment, Tottenham, whenever they come up against a team lower than them in the table, They showcase their swashbuckling best. I won't go back to those games against Burnley and Crystal Palace where they were absolutely wonderful to watch, and they just showed what they could do. Whenever they come up against a team that's of the same ability or above them, they just shrink. The players completely shrink and their performances stall. They'll play for a few minutes. I mean, the Newcastle game recently, that summed it up. They start brightly, they don't score. They they go passive for 20-odd minutes. They fall behind. That sparks them into life. They score twice in 4 minutes. And you just think, oh, they're going to steamroller their way to it now. Then they sort of settle on this, we're going to play on the break now. They miss the chances that they do create on the break, and they ended up conceding a late equaliser. And to be honest, it felt justified at the time. And I think that sums them up. And that wasn't against the team that's levelled them in the table. That's the team that was fourth bottom. If I was a Tottenham fan, I would be exasperated at the moment, and I suspect I would be directing my ire at the management more than the players.
In that case, Miggs, Daniel Levy, he's probably got two key decisions to make. Does he stay with Mourinho, and will he let Harry Kane go? And if so, where would he let him go? How do you see it all panning out?
I think it's why this League Cup final is so... I mean, right now, you wouldn't think Spurs have much of a chance, but it is one game, all the rest of it. But if they win the League Cup, there is the season could at least be spun as a success, because let's not... I mean, Levy is particularly attached to disappointment. I mean, when he made it, he was going on about how Mourinho is one of the top two managers in world football, which is something that really hadn't been true for about 5 years before, and that no one else in football was talking about. And there's been a lot of discussion about how it's the one managerial appointment that Levy always wanted to make, almost as much because it says about the development of Spurs as a club. So up to now, he would have been very invested, I think, in this succeeding. So if they go and win the League Cup, it at least provides some credence for that. But of course, there's bigger arguments about what a League Cup would actually mean in the grander scheme of things. I mean, Spurs' last two trophy winners, which also happened to be League Cup, were Juan de Ramos and George Graham. They're hardly managerial legends in the history of the club. just because you referenced Pochettino at the start, all of this does feel like also it's somewhat... It provides more justification for Pochettino's entire argument that Spurs are better off putting more and more resources into the top two competitions, because if this is what winning a trophy means, which is an otherwise moribund season, then what's the point? And if they do win it, we will get into a bigger discussion over whether it actually signifies something as regards progress for the club. But yeah, I do think it will be absolutely key to any decision. I also think, I mean, there are justifications, of course, to sack Mourinho now. But I don't think they're doing so, or even really even thinking about that, because the League Cup is on the horizon. By extension, also, from what you hear, obviously we've been going through the usual process with Mourinho and his squad, and there are more and more players that aren't exactly bewitched by his motivational approach. But it's not like there's been anything like open rebellion or anything like that. Players want to play in this final. They want to have a chance at that trophy. So it's been any sort of discord has been subdued, really. And then, of course, there's the Kane question, given, well, he does want a lot more than League Cup medals. But for him, it would still be significant to get that first trophy of his career. Looking forward, I think, just based on my own gut and, I suppose, how, you know, bits of info we have at the moment, I think Spurs will make a change in the summer. Although Nagelsmann's future has maybe put a little bit of create a bit of a complication there, given I think there was a point when Spurs thought there was a good chance they could get him. Well, now it looks like he's going to Bayern Munich. I suppose that was always somewhat predictable, given he was always going to have an array of the biggest jobs to choose from this summer. So it will be dependent on the potential replacement for Mourinho. But it just feels like the way the situation is going and the frustration among the fans, especially if they lose this League Cup final, will just naturally lead to that. And then, of course, there's the Kane decision, and you know it comes down to everything with Levy, doesn't it? He's got his price. I mean, he's never going to be absolutely obstinate on these things, particularly given the financial issues that Spurs have with the stadium. But I personally think it's doubtful that anyone is going to go to the price that Levy would require to sell, especially at that age and given Kane's injury record. I mean, he's an absolute guarantee of goals. He's obviously got a few years left, but it's still an immense price to be paying for a 27-year-old. And I think it would take one of the big clubs to be desperate, and I'm not sure they will be that desperate this summer.
Yeah, well, there'll certainly be more whispers and moans, won't there, if things go badly awry at Everton on Friday evening as well. that will cloud any build-up to the League Cup final. Across Merseyside, Liverpool, Dom, lost to Real Madrid. In terms of targets, top four is still there. Is Klopp almost not in the mood, probably the wrong way to put it, but is Klopp, is his state of mind almost appreciable now, though, that he can actually drive a team to the top four? In other words, they need to win at Leeds on Monday. Can he turn it round?
You know what? That's probably the worst fixture that he could have possibly had for a game where you say he needs an immediate response. He needs Liverpool to consider this run in as a title run in almost. You know, I don't want to use the cliche of a succession of cup finals because people don't play a succession of cup finals, but they need to go on a winning streak. And for them to suddenly come up on a Monday night against that Leeds team with that energy and that running and that drive and that swarming style that Liverpool used to pride themselves in to a certain extent, but after the season they've had, I doubt they'll be able to muster in quite the same way. I think that's a really, really difficult test for Liverpool, and an immediate test as an immediate examination of how their running will go and what can still be achieved this season. I mean, it's just been a year to forget for Liverpool Football Club. It wasn't really a great surprise what happened at Anfield on Wednesday. It was almost a microcosm of their season. Profligate at one end, and that's completely undermined their chances. Okay, they were defensively, they did well and kept that clean sheet, but the defensive frailties had already been exploited in the first game at Real's training ground. So over the two legs of the tie, that's pretty much Liverpool's season. It hasn't been good enough, and there are certain mitigating factors, obviously, with the injuries, but a lot of clubs have had injuries this season and had key absentees as well. So they'll just be desperate to get to that summer, preferably in the top four with Champions League football to come, because that will speed the rebuild as well, and then attack next season with something that's more recognisable as a Klopp Liverpool.
Yeah, Dom, speaking of a rebuild there, Migs, do you share my sense that transition's coming, and perhaps the focal point of that will be Mo Salah? It does seem that the word out of the Salah camp, if you like, Rami Abbas is his lawyer, you know, the word is he's not desperate to leave, but he's concerned the club might not see the future in the same way. If you read between those sort of lines, you can see a summer transfer happening, can't you?
Although it's funny, I don't know if they've slightly shifted position, but that language about him wanting to stay is interesting, because I would argue actually that, not unrelated to what we're talking about with Kane, but the market for Salah might have dried up. Brilliant as he is, but in this market, and given the evolution of the transfer market in that way, I can't see clubs being willing to pay that much money for someone in his late 20s, which is, of course, one of the major issues that we're talking about with Liverpool here. I mean, there hasn't been much, for obvious reasons, I suppose, there hasn't been much new youthful energy or much kind of change put into that team really for 3 years now. I mean, someone last night actually sent me the lineup they had for a summer friendly against Napoli in Dublin, which is pretty much the same, you know, bar a few alterations, is close to the same team they've got now. So that's 3 years now. And I think we've discussed this in the squad before, but it was always kind of the Alex Ferguson maximum, the most you can have, or the longest cycle you can have with any group of players is 3 to 4 years before you need significant change. Liverpool seem identifiably at that point, with that most visible in the strike force, because of that three that have been so crucial for so long. They're all, what, around 28, and I think all within 6 months of each other in terms of age. So that is where you should see change. The only thing is, I mean, you do wonder whether one of the effects of the crisis for the club was that it maybe derailed their succession plan a little bit. I mean, perhaps in a different world, they would have willingly sold on one of Mane or Salah to one of the Spanish clubs who would have paid that much, so they could bring in a Sancho or players 5 years younger just to refresh that attack in a way that's required. But now we're in a world where, I mean, Madrid, they don't really have interest in Salah anymore. They want Haaland and Mbappe.
Yeah, and their president wants a European Super League. So we'll see how that one pans out, won't we? You know, talking of European elements and, you know, UEFA specifically, I'd just like to end on the case of Andre Kudela, banned for 10 games for racist behaviour. Now, while the UEFA decision has been made, there's still a criminal investigation ongoing with Police Scotland. So we need to be delicate here. But I think it's important to challenge UEFA on the type of punishments they are handing out in what is, okay, it's a delicate, but an absolutely fundamental issue, which strikes to the heart of the anti-racism debate. Dom, give you first go at this. 10 games, no Euros perhaps, but really, is that appropriate?
Well, it's the bare minimum that they could sanction him, having deemed him guilty of racist behaviour. And to provide a bit of context, if they are saying that he was guilty of that racist behaviour, then they're also saying that his punishment is only worthy of 7 matches more than the man who was abused and reacting by smacking him, basically, which, again, just seems bizarre, although obviously it looks as if Glenn Kamara and his legal team will challenge that 3-match ban once they've seen the full written reasons behind UEFA's decision. I mean, look, it's when you put it into the context of some other sanctions that UEFA hand out, whether that be Kieran Trippier for was it 12 games that he got?
12, yeah.
For basically saying that, telling a mate that he was going to join Atletico Madrid. Or I think there were a couple of players who got 3-month bans for a banned substance after taking pills for altitude sickness. And this is a 10-match ban for saying what he allegedly said. It does seem pathetic, to be honest. It seems as if he's got away with it, even with the prospect of missing the Euros and Slavia Prague's imminent, well, Europa League run this time round and whatever they're playing in next season. But are we surprised? No, I wouldn't say we are. I think the way that it came out from UEFA was almost like they were very self-congratulatory. Look, we've given him a 10-match ban. We're taking this really seriously. Well, in the context of everything else, they're really not.
And that context is key because, I mean, already it feels like a punishment from, say, 3 years ago. And even 3 years ago, UEFA were getting hammered for these kind of light punishments of racial abuse. But the thing is, I mean, the dial has significantly moved against it. I mean, we're at a point right now where football is at least putting out the image that they're trying to lead the way on racial abuse, particularly as regards, say, the issue of online abuse. And I mean, just as a bit of a tangent, I wouldn't say I'm uncomfortable with the way that conversation's developing, but it does feel like there's been a bit too much fixation of online. When to me, I mean, just before the pandemic hit, we'd been doing a bit of research on a piece about the growth of racial abuse in stands, and we had a fair bit of anecdotal evidence, and it doesn't feel completely unconnected from that. So I think, but you know, setting that aside, yeah, we're in a world where football is trying to lead the way and trying to set an example as to how to tackle this whole issue, and it's why, given that, a mere 10 games looks even worse and just kind of lessens the impact of it. And it feels like it feeds into the idea that football only does kind of, it just takes cosmetic responses to this rather than any deeper structural issues. Some clubs and some individuals, obviously, as honourable exceptions.
Well, we've gone way beyond token gestures and punishments that are little more than a nod and a wink. Kudela and Slavia will probably appeal, as is their right, but there must be no politically expedient backsliding. In my view, the 10-match ban destroys UEFA's credibility. There is no sense of fairness in that judgment. As Troy Townsend, a veteran of the anti-racism struggle, says, victims are becoming victimised by this process. What do you think? It's a key issue, and please let me know. In the meantime, thanks to Miguel and Dom for their insight, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.